friends, welcome. Bienvenidos. Hola. Aloha. Ni hao. Namaste. Konnichiwa. Bonjour. Buongiorno. Sawadee karab. Guten tag. Jau wivi vakat bang. Half a day. Jai Janendra. Salam. Shalom. Peace. Now. Go vegan. Peace how? Go vegan. From the left coast of the genetically mutated McNugget pharmaceutical, vivisection prison, killitary industrial core, poor nation. In the cheese-covered, post-constitutional, bankster-bankrupt, corruptocracy-mocracy-criminocracy of the United States of Listeria, food-borne in the USA, home of Uncle Salmonella, where they sure do eat a lot of dead animal body parts, and the Wall Street-backed corporate diet of death, disease, and destruction is shoved down your throat. This is Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden. And, well, it's that time of year once again. Halloween is upon us. Let me see if I can get into character for this. Let me commit to the character. Yeah. Once again, Halloween is upon us. And the message in 2013, you're not superstitious, are you? The message in 2013 is go vegan or die. Go vegan or die. Be scared. Be very scared. You have made your stomach a graveyard. You are a walking cemetery. Look all around you. Walking graveyards everywhere. Mutant beings who dine on animal sacrifice, who munch on corpses, and then wash them down with a blood-filled witch's brew, taken from the mammary glands of creatures with hooves and horns. Is that a horn you're growing? Or a tumor? Fed by the hormones and flesh and blood of others. Look around you at the ones who drink the milk dripping from the bovine gland. All bloodthirsty vampires, and satisfying their taste for blood with cow's milk, full of bloody pus cells called somatic cells. Here, have your milliliter of cow's milk. The USDA says it's grade A. If it has up to 750,000 bloody pus cells per milliliter. I want to suck your blood. And by the way, 1 milliliter equals 0.033 of an ounce. About 5 milliliters per teaspoon. What does that mean? Stuyvesant High School math student here. 3,750,000 bloody pus cells allowable per teaspoon. And let's see. And yes, the USDA statistics for 2010 show the average milliliter of cow's milk had 224,000 pussy white bloody cells. So that average then to, let's see, 1,120,000. Yes, per milliliter. So, okay, so drink up, vampires. Wash down the bloody cadavers that make you the mutant being that you are. You are what you eat, or whom you eat, and you dine on mutant beings who eat a mutant diet of GMOs, genetically mutant organizations, organisms. Okay, back into character here. There was nothing funny about that. Okay, you make yourself and your children into Frankenstein-like experiments. Oh, and all the animals in laboratories live lives of horror too, in experiments to find a cure to your horrible diet of death, destruction, and disease. Go vegan or die. Go vegan or die. Soothsayer T. Colin Campbell, with the largest study of diet and death ever, says 90% of fatal degenerative disease is caused by eating protein of animals. Magician wizard Caldwell Esselstyn, MD, has kept people alive who are on the brink of death with a magic potion of fruits, vegetables, grains, nuts, seeds, legumes, a vegan diet, as have other wizard MDs, McDougal and Clapper, and so many others. Can you escape the revenge of the spirits of the hundreds of animals buried in the graveyard of your stomach? Can you escape their plagues, the curse of heart disease, cancer, stroke, diabetes? Go vegan or die. And why should the animals die? Why should their lives be real horror? Not a horror story. It's not a movie for them. When the monster comes with the hatchet, it's not fake blood. It's real blood. It's not a ghost costume. It's real death. It's not a skeleton costume. They are sliced to the bone. And if we don't change our evil ways, watch how much of our real-life horror story unfolds in front of us. If you really want to be scared, here come the wildfires, the floods, the drought, the tornadoes. Because animal agriculture causes 51% of all greenhouse gas emissions. It is also time for the environmental movement to take off its costume, its mask, and join in the spirit. Repeat after me, environmental movement. Go vegan or die. Go vegan or die. Okay. All right. Whew, that felt good. All right. That's my annual Halloween. My annual Halloween persona there. So you're getting the message? I certainly hope so. And also the message, you know, there are many vegan Halloween treats. Tweets? My brain is on Twitter, huh? Just want to let you know that many candies out there are vegan. I think maybe we'll go over some of them here and let you know what you can, when the kids come by, you don't have to give them, you know, the bloody treats that have animal products. Airheads Taffy is vegan. Let's see here. Allison's Gourmet has many, many vegan items. Apple pie fudge, artisan vegan caramels, artisan... well, just you can check Allison's Gourmet, just a wonderful list of vegan products there. Also, Annie's Organic Fruit Snacks are vegan. Biona Organic Tutti Frutti wine gums are vegan. Brock's Fruit Slices, Charms Blow Pops. Let's see, as we continue to look down our little vegan list. Yeah, let's see here. Atkinson's Chico Stick. Chicago Vegan Foods, Dandy's Marshmallows are vegan. Nice to get away from the gelatin there, right? Cool Cups are vegan also, so you might enjoy them. Let's see, what else do we have here? Cliff Kid Organic Twisted Fruit. Crispy Cat Candy Bars are vegan. The Mint Coconut and Toasted Almond. Cracker Jack Original Caramel Coated Popcorn and Peanuts. And let's see, what else? Dum Dums are vegan. If you're also looking for other vegan treats, Endangered Species, Organic Dark Chocolate Bug Bites are vegan. The Organic Dark Chocolate Chimp Mints are vegan also. Let's see, Ginger People has a number of vegan treats for the kids. Go Max Go Foods, the Buccaneer Bar, Cleo's Peanut Butter Cups, Joker's, Mahalo, Sharp, Twilight, all vegan. Goody Good Stuff vegan. Jolly Rancher Hard Candy. Let's Do Organic. So Mary Jane's are vegan, and Newman's Own Licorice Twists are vegan. The Panda Licorice, the Blueberry Licorice, Candy-Coated Licorice, Cherry, Raspberry, Soft. Pez Candy, believe it or not, Pez Candy, huh? Vegan. Remember having those little Pez dispensers as a kid? I wish my mother didn't throw them away. I'd be rich today, right? Collector's items, along with the baseball cards and the Lionel trains. Let's see, pure organic fruit snacks. So, Jacques, wonderful organic chocolates are vegan too. Skittles, vegan. And let's see, Smarties Sour Patch, a bunch of those. So, we do have many choices for vegan options out there. Whizzers, chocolate beans, Yummy Earth. So many, many vegan options coming up for you on Halloween. I want to tell you a bit about today's program, Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden. Coming up on today's show, we will be talking to Peter Young. Peter Young, animal liberation activist, participates in animal liberation activism that some would consider outside the law, some consider above the law. He was the first charged under the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act for terrorism for Animal Liberation Front actions in which he participated, releasing thousands of mink. Then you'll also want to tell all your friends to tune in because we'll be talking to Tim Zimmerman. Tim Zimmerman is the co-producer and writer of Blackfish. He'll be coming up on today's program, that being seen on CNN this past week and tonight, the screening of Blackfish, which I saw. It seems to confirm everything I think about SeaWorld, that there's nothing good about SeaWorld. Nice if SeaWorld were to go out of business like immediately, huh? Also coming up next hour, as we have expanded to a two-hour program, we'll have animal rights commentary with Professor Gary Francione. We'll be talking about the Happy Meat corporate sponsorships that are compromising the animal rights movement, and we will also talk to Michael Budke of Stop Animal Exploitation Now. Michael Budke just doing his West Coast tour, anti-vivisection conference, and he'll be filling us in on some horrible things going on at the University of Oklahoma. Please support this program. We'd appreciate a tax-deductible donation. We pay for airtime in certain cities, and we'd like to be on in New York and Chicago. You can click donate at goveganradio.com. It's Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden, goveganradio.com. Started to mention that, now we've been broadcasting for 12 years, as heard on Air America and CBS and Clear Channel radio stations, now nationally syndicated by the Genesis Communications Network. We've expanded to 2 hours on Sundays from 5 to 7 p.m. We are live. A couple of radio stations who used to run this program while we were on Air America, WWRL in New York and WCPT in Chicago, would really like to be running the program again, but since deregulation and consolidation of the media, it's required sometimes to pay for airtime. I think that they're offering reasonable rates, meaning New York would charge us $300 per hour or $600 per week, and Chicago $200 per hour or $400 per week. That's $1,000 per week. So we could use support in the form of tax-deductible donations, which you can make your donation at goveganradio.com and click donate, or make your check payable to Go Vegan Radio and mail it to P.O. Box 475-414, San Francisco, California, 94147. And also, you can become a sponsor of the program and advertise your vegan and cruelty-free products and services. Email me. It's Bob at goveganradio.com. And Michael Butke, who will be on later in the program, has committed a $2,000 donation. He's putting the challenge out there for others to join Stop Animal Exploitation Now in making sure that Go Vegan Radio keeps going and keeps growing. So if you want to help with the challenge, please do so. And we also want to thank Kim Sheridan for her support. Kim Sheridan, author of the heartwarming award-winning book Animals and the Afterlife, and visit animalsandtheafterlife.com. animalsandtheafterlife.com. So the message, as you heard earlier, my Halloween message every year is go vegan or die. And of course, millions of people die from the consumption of animal products because of heart disease, cancer, stroke, diabetes, etc. And it is not painful to go vegan. We have the best food. That's, you know, part of the joy is that when you go vegan, you are going to love what you're eating. And, you know, just as an example, you know, if you want to say, oh, well, what do vegans eat? Go to the website of a Vegetarian House. It's a great restaurant in San Jose. It's at 520 East Santa Clara Street. It's vegetarianhouse.us, vegetarianhouse.us. Just look at the menu. Just look at the international menu at Vegetarian House. Vegetarian House is available for catering in the Bay Area, whether it's a wedding or corporate event, just a few people or 1,000 people. You'll love the food from Vegetarian House, 520 East Santa Clara Street. It's 100% vegan restaurant, organic, non-GMO, many raw options. And, you know, just look at the menu, you know, and also just Google vegan recipes. You'll see that we really do have the best food, and you'll greatly enjoy it. And, you know, when I was saying before that it's time for the environmental movement to take the mask off and the costume and recognize the need to go vegan, well, there'll be another one of those climate change conferences coming up next month in Poland, between November 11th and the 22nd, when, again, nothing will get done. And nobody will ask for the right things to get done. And it goes on and on. And yet, we're told that animal agriculture is responsible for 51% of all greenhouse gas emissions. Now, also, in terms of water, and, you know, there are some staggering statistics, and I've often pointed out that a vegan requires 10,000 gallons of water to grow his or her food in a year, and a flesh eater, a meat eater, needs 320,000 gallons of water. So that's 32 times what a vegan needs, or 32 people can be fed, you know, 32 meat eaters, 32 vegans can be fed to what one meat eater is squandering. And 1.1 billion people around the world lack access to safe drinking water, and yet we waste 3.8 trillion tons of precious clean water every year for livestock production. So, I mean, where are our priorities? I guess we'll be focusing on environmental issues over the weeks ahead. We have Peter Young coming up next on Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden. And as I said, also Tim Zimmerman, writer and associate producer of Blackfish, Professor Gary Francione, also coming up on Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden. With Bob Linden, goveganradio.com. Sorry, I was getting lost in the music, reminding me of my old days at Jazzy 100 in Washington, D.C., the good old days when I just played music on the radio and didn't talk about animal suffering. and attempting to alleviate it. On Twitter, you can follow us at Go Vegan Radio, and occasionally people can get into my two maxed out pages at on Facebook, the two Bob Linden pages, but preferably you should go to Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden. So Peter Young has been an animal rights activist for over 15 years. He was the first person charged with animal enterprise terrorism after carrying out Animal Liberation Front actions, which saw the release of thousands of mink from Midwest fur farms in the 1990s. And then after 7 years as a fugitive, Young served 2 years in federal prison. At various times, Peter Young has been a fugitive, activist, author, prisoner, felon, spokesperson, animal liberator, protester, entrepreneur, saboteur, publisher, speaker, and criminal of conscience. I guess that means he can't hold down a job either, just like me. By various people and agencies, he has been called a terrorist, eco-terrorist, special interest terrorist, burglar, accessory after the fact, danger to the community, flight risk, unindicted co-conspirator, and member of the Animal Liberation Front. Since his release, Young remains active in the fight for animal liberation as an activist, speaker, and spokesperson for those who work outside or above the law to save animals. And by the way, I would like to welcome our new listeners today, those who are in the FBI, the NSA, Department of Homeland Security. Welcome, and going vegan will be good for you, too, for your family's health, heart disease, cancer, stroke. You know, so just wanted to welcome you all. And how are you today, Peter?
Hey, I'm fantastic, Bob. How are you?
Great, great, great. So thanks for being with us. And, well, tell us, what motivated you, and I don't know if you can generalize to others, but, you know, what motivated you for your course, your path in animal liberation, which is, you know, what is considered above the law in many ways?
Sure. I had spent, this is going back a number of years to the mid-90s, but I had spent a couple of years as an above-ground mainstream activist. I was doing what a lot of us do. I was standing outside of fur stores and McDonald's and leafleting and so forth. And me and some friends got together, and there was a conversation taking place about how the change that we were seeking just wasn't happening fast enough, and how there had to be another set of tactics that we can employ, you know, to complement our daytime activism, not necessarily to replace it, but just to complement it, that would allow us to save animals in the short term. And so, you know, that sort of evolved, and that led us down the road of Animal Liberation Front tactics and rescuing animals from places such as farms, and as well as small-scale sabotage actions, which I very quickly kind of phased myself out of because I didn't really feel like that was being effective either. But ultimately, that kind of culminated in a road trip that me and a friend embarked upon, in which we raided a half dozen fur farms in the Midwest just before pelting season was to begin. And that model was generally just cutting fences at a fur farm, opening cages and releasing mink. And mink are one of the only species that we intensively can find in this country that are native to North America and are still genetically wild. So that made them a very appetizing, fur farms very appetizing for us in terms of, you know, you can release 3,000 animals in a matter of 30 or 40 minutes. So when you compare that to what we'd been doing for 2 years, which was, you know, waving signs outside of a research lab, hoping that maybe somehow that might someday translate to saved animals, you really couldn't compare. I mean, there's just way more bang for your buck working outside the law. So that's what we did. And eventually, as you referenced in the intro, I served some prison time for those actions.
Mm-hmm. And so are there many of these actions happening now? I mean, they don't seem to make it into mainstream media, but how active are people working above or outside of the law in doing such Animal Liberation Front activities?
You know, it goes in waves, and what we're seeing right now has been an incredible surge of ALF activity. We've seen, and actually it has gotten quite a bit of mainstream coverage in the last several weeks. In particular, the New York Times just did a big story on this this resurgence of fur farm raids that has been happening since about July. We've seen 9 raids of fur farms around the country, which is an incredible pace, something we haven't really seen since the late 1990s. And you've had farms in Idaho, Montana, Utah, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Iowa, and Illinois have all been hit in the last several months. So it does go in waves. Right now it seems to be sort of a fur wave. You also see waves of activity that center around laboratories or factory farms, and it tends to be kind of, kind of cyclical. So, but right now it's a tremendous offensive against the fur industry, and it's really exciting to see because it doesn't seem to be any end in sight.
Now, you were charged with animal enterprise terrorism, and the Animal Liberation Front has been called like a top terrorist organization. Tell us a bit about the Animal Liberation Front, and is it a terrorist organization or what?
It's a counter-terrorist organization, as a matter of fact. The Animal Liberation Front quite plainly seeks to intervene when humans are abusing animals and there are no laws to stop them. So that could take the form of taking a chicken out of an egg farm. That could take the form of removing animals from a laboratory. At times, it can take the form of burning down a slaughterhouse. So there's quite a range of tactics. But as far as calling the ALF a terrorist organization, I think any sane person without an agenda would consider that laughable. You picture somebody, cradling an injured chicken, running across the field from an egg farm in the middle of the night, not exactly the image of a terrorist. I could attack that from so many different angles. It's insulting to the victims of real terrorism. It is just a bumbling PR move on the part of governments as well as animal industries to somehow turn the public against the ALF. And I really do feel like the public, by and large, when you're talking about rescuing an animal from an abusive situation, the public, by and large, supports those actions. Depending on how you frame the question, but if you said to somebody, if there's an animal in this abusive situation that was suffering horribly and there was no law to stop them, to stop the abusers, do you think it's acceptable for someone to intervene? I think most people would say yes. And that really, at its essence, is what the ALF does. So to call the ALF a terrorist organization is quite laughable.
So has any human or animal ever been hurt in an ALF action?
No, absolutely not, and that's part of the ALF code, is to not injure any human or animal. That would just be fundamentally at odds with the mission of the ALF. So it's never happened.
So basically, it sounds like the rescue of animals. Nobody gets hurt, and you're being equated to somebody flying airplanes into the World Trade Center or setting off a bomb somewhere. At the Boston Marathon or whatever that might be. And that's how did it get to be that level? How could it be considered a level of terrorism then? What made it that?
Well, it's interesting because I feel like the only element that makes it a, quote, terrorist act is the element of selflessness. And what I mean by that is if you were to go and burn down a building solely for the sake of getting your kicks off of being an arsonist, that would just be a simple arson charge. Or if you were to break the window of a butcher shop just because you just wanted to go out and cause some mischief, that would be a vandalism charge. But when there's nothing in it for you, for example, most arsons are insurance fraud. But if you burn down a slaughterhouse to save animals, the only variable would be there's nothing in it for the perpetrator at that point, then it becomes terrorism. So it's interesting when you think about it. The only variable that makes it terrorism is that it's motivated by selflessness and a desire to help animals. And again, I just really feel like it's an idea whose time is arriving, and I feel like especially, you cover this on your show, just the surge of veganism in the mainstream. And I feel like there's some powerful people with a lot of money who are very scared about this this rising consciousness. And just one small part of that is labeling people that work outside the law to save animals as terrorists.
So their terror is in losing profits. That terrorizes them, that they would be losing profits. But the animals are actually being terrorized by their activities. So it's, as usual, everything is upside down in
this society, exactly. Basically, you know, so,
yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, when you speak at events and, you know, all now, what are you, how are you advising new people to approach activism, animal rights activism? What are you telling people?
You know, I tell people to just look at what their strengths are and leverage those strengths. I mean, I'm certainly not, you know, telling anyone to go out and break the law. I'm certainly happy when people do that, of course, in a strategic way. But, you know, I talk a lot about sort of mental hurdles that I had to overcome as an activist to get involved. I talk a lot about fear and overcoming fear. I do talk a lot about the ALF because I think it's important to demystify that. And frankly, that's just kind of my platform. You know, if I were to get up there and at a podium and sort of pitch myself as a factory farming expert, it's not really what my platform is. So I do talk about the ALF, and I think it's important to keep that dialogue alive. And, you know, more and more, I feel like when I got involved in mainstream animal rights movement, the Animal Liberation Front, it was sort of a legitimized tactic, and, you know, not many people partook of those tactics, but it was very much not something that was shrouded in mystery. And I feel like that's changed a lot. I think there's been a shift towards... And this is one way where the terrorism rhetoric has been successful because it's kind of seeped into the fabric of the mainstream movement where you have mainstream animal rights activists sort of being against the ALF and almost feeling like it's kind of a stain on our movement or I have you know countless examples of people who work for mainstream animal rights organizations sort of not even wanting to have any public association with me because of how that might appear to the public if word were to get out that someone at XYZ animal rights organization was affiliated with this convicted eco-terrorist. I mean, so it kind of, it seeps in different ways, but...
We have to take a break. We have to take a break, but we'll talk more with Peter Young coming up on Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden. I regularly run for president of the ALF, and I'm in my second term right now. So, you know, we'll talk more with Peter Young at Go Vegan Radio. Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden, goveganradio.com. Today we are talking to Peter Young, who was the first person charged with animal enterprise terrorism for his Animal Liberation Front actions, which were to release thousands of mink from fur farms in the Midwest. It's amazing, though, not neo-Nazis at the top of the terrorist list or, you know, white supremacist groups or whatever. It's, you know, it's the Animal Liberation Front, for which I am serving my second consecutive term as elected president. So, Peter, they label this terrorism, yet when you were caught, you only served 2 years in federal prison? Is that like a...
Yeah, that's right. And I was extremely fortunate in a number of ways, one of which is that I was charged with animal enterprise terrorism before it was even a felony. So when I got indicted, it was 1998, and I was arrested in 2005. So had I been charged in 2005, it would have been a totally different story. But in 1998, it was just a misdemeanor. So I served a maximum of 1 year each on two different counts.
Mm. And that's really, it's if you affect the profits of an animal enterprise. That's, you know, part of what's how the law is written. That's the terrorism,
right.
If you affect the profits. So do you feel that this kind of outside of the law activism or above the law activism is effective? Does it shut down any businesses or does it cut down, you know, on animal, you know, products made of animals or what do you think?
Sure. I think that the ALF absolutely, so first of all, saves animals. That can't be argued. When you've got, you know, we'll just take a fur farm, for example, you release these animals into the wild, there's no animals on standby to replace the animals that get released. So those animals, when they're saved, they're saved. So that's really important. And I think it's really important as activists to never lose sight of the importance of a single life. I think it's easy to get caught up in numbers, and we talk about the billions of animals killed every year and what's just a few, but, you know, those lives matter to those individual animals, and the ALF is definitely a solution to save individual animals. There have been quite a few instances of businesses that have been shut down by the ALF. Probably most of those businesses have been fur farms. I don't know of any in the U.S. I'm just speaking in terms of there's been a lot more victories overseas, but we've seen a lot of animals saved and quite a few businesses shut down as a result of the ALF, certainly.
And you have a website?
I do have a website, animalliberationfrontline.com.
Okay. And my understanding is that I think that if someone is arrested related to an incident with animals, the police have to notify the FBI. Am I hearing that correctly?
Yeah, isn't that interesting? If you were around your tool shed and find $10,000 worth of tools missing, that would just be local issue for the local police. But if one chicken is missing from your farm, the police are required to report this to the FBI. Quite interesting.
Well, that's amazing. So, and there's a lot of activity overseas, you say? I mean, in addition to here?
Quite a lot. On my website, I only cover the United States just to keep the scope reasonable for me to keep up with. But yeah, the ALF historically has been much more active overseas in a way that I think U.S. activists should really look to and draw a lot of inspiration from.
It actually started in the U.K., right? Ronnie Lee?
Started in the U.K., yeah. A gentleman named Ronnie Lee co-founded the ALF. And so that was in the 1970s, and it has been very consistent ever since. It's been a worldwide movement. It's just one of those things where it's an idea that once it took hold, you can never extinguish it, which is why the FBI is going to be so futile in trying to stop the ALF, is that this is something that's very practical. It's a very pragmatic solution to a very urgent problem, and you're not going to ever be able to stop that.
Do you know of anything that just happened recently at all, elsewhere outside of the U.S. too? Or
overseas? The trend of fur farm raids in the U.S. has definitely been maintained in Canada as well, so we've seen a lot of that here in North America. I think a few days ago there were 1,000 mink released from a farm in Denmark. There's really almost too much to keep up with overseas. If you go to a website, the best website to go to is directaction.info, and that website updates ALF actions internationally. It's quite impressive to see what's going on overseas.
Directaction.info. So yeah, and no, there don't call me if you're interested in getting involved in any sort of activities, right?
I get those emails. I mean, literally 1 to 3 a day. How do I join the ALF? How do I get involved? And I just hit delete because the ALF is it's something you do. It's not something you join.
It's, yes, right. Keep it to yourself. I don't want to know about it. Okay, thanks for being with us today, Peter Young. And thank you, all the new listeners, members of the FBI and NSA and all. We hope you'll go vegan, too, and have a different attitude about animals and their liberation. Thanks, Peter. Greetings again. It is the second hour of Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden, nationally syndicated by the Genesis Communications Network. Yes, we've expanded to 2 hours. We're live 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. on Sundays, Pacific time. We're glad you're here. And very happy today to be talking to Tim Zimmerman, who is the associate producer and co-writer of Blackfish, which is a documentary that is really making waves, kind of making a tsunami for SeaWorld. It's his first documentary, which is, I don't know, how do you top that, huh? Tim is an award-winning writer for Outside Magazine, where he writes about the oceans and marine life. His interest in orcas led to the 2010 publication In Outside of Killer in the Pool, an investigation of the death of Don Brancho, and 2011's Blood in the Water, which examined the death of Lauro Parque's killer whale trainer Alexis Martinez. Mr. Zimmerman's work has appeared in Sports Illustrated and Men's Journal. Prior to his work with Outside Magazine, he was a diplomatic correspondent for U.S. News and World Report. And he continues to write about orcas, marine life, and the natural world at timzimmerman.com. Maybe you saw him on Crossfire a few days ago with Newt Gingrich and Van Jones. And I guess that was good practice to be on Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden. How are you today, Tim?
I'm doing great. Yeah, cuddly Newt Gingrich is definitely good practice.
If you can get through that, you know, so, yeah, you can. What first interested you in orcas? What caught your attention to make you take you where you've gone?
Well, it's been an incredible journey, I have to say that. I've always been interested in the oceans. I'm a sailor. I've spent a lot of time on the seas. I'd never seen orcas in the wild before. But when Don Brancho was killed, it caught my attention. It was nationwide news. But the thing that really got me going was that I did a little bit of investigation, and as soon as I read that Tilikum had been involved in two previous deaths, I immediately started to think there must be some incredible backstory here. And I wanted to do a feature story about Tilikum, and I thought of it as a kind of diary of a killer whale, and I wanted to try to tell the story of his life in the hopes that readers would then be able to hopefully understand a little bit about why he might have killed a trainer, Don Brancho, as well as the two previous folks.
Mm. And it's so well told. I mean, you do talk about Tilikum's life and what a sympathetic creature he is. I mean, you know, in spite of what he did, it's almost to be expected. I mean, who could bear the life that he was given by SeaWorld? I mean, there seems to be nothing right about SeaWorld, nothing right from the start. I mean, as you see in the film, it's awful right from the capture, the training. I mean, it's just awful. And tell us a bit about how unnatural, their lives are.
Well, this is a big point that I've been thinking about recently, and it's something that struck me throughout the reporting on this, which is that SeaWorld can keep killer whales, which are protected by the Marine Mammal Protection Act, which came in the 1970s and helped end all the captures, wild captures, under a kind of a loophole or an exclusion where institutions are allowed to display marine mammals for educational purposes. And so there's a lot of talk about SeaWorld as like a zoo and an aquarium, and it just, the more you learn about SeaWorld, the more you realize it's not really a zoo at all. I mean, if you go to a good zoo, there's natural enclosures, there's every effort to make the habitat for the animals as natural as possible, and to tell the folks coming through as much as they can about the natural history of the animals. And SeaWorld has none of that. I mean, it has. You know, basically enormous swimming pool tanks. There's no natural features, really. There's lots of mechanical noise, and you can understand for an orca which uses echolocation and sound, really, for one of its primary senses, how disturbing that might be. There's no families of killer whales there. There's random collection of whales that get put together. And you start to understand how unnatural, really, and intuitively, uncomfortable and unsuitable that sort of environment is for a killer whale. And then as you dig further, you just discover one thing after the other, which just makes you kind of question the whole idea that it's ethical or even correct to keep a killer whale in captivity, when you realize that they grind their teeth on the bars. You know, they injure one another. There's even an incident in which one whale killed itself, really attacking another whale. You learn that they're on antibiotics all the time, suffering from infections. You learn that they get ulcers and they have to take Tagamet. You learn that they're on antidepressants. And so it's really, once you peel back the facade that SeaWorld has created, and it's a very effective one. I mean, SeaWorld PR has effectively defined how we think about killer whales for 30 or 40 years. You start to understand just how unnatural and different and unsuitable the whole thing is, and that's what we try to do in the film. And I think that Gabriella Cowperthwaite, the director, really did a phenomenal job of bringing that across to the audiences.
It really is a phenomenal documentary. It's being shown on CNN, and it's so moving. I mean, right from the start, when you see the capture, And then, you know, the people who were participating in the capture regretting it, you know. I mean, everybody, it's a movie, it seems, of regrets, you know. I mean, the people regretting, you know, participating in the capture, the training. I think the trainers themselves felt deceived by SeaWorld, you know. I mean, look at all of the former trainers who were interviewed in the movie and who have no idea. I mean, SeaWorld does it wrong right from the start and throws together incompatible whales to where, you know, it's a constant confrontational environment that that Telecom had to face, right?
That's right. I mean, it's, you know, killer whales live in very tightly bonded family groups, and it's a matriarchal society where the females really run the show, and they, the oldest females are really, you know, they direct the killer whale pods. They help, they know where the food is, they know what seasons to move in, and so you can imagine how displacing it would be to be a three-year-old killer whale in the midst of a family group and suddenly be netted and pulled into a tank in Iceland. And to stay there for a year by yourself most of the time before you're sold to a park, you know, in Canada, and then to go to that park and be dropped in the water with two females who are trying to establish dominance over one another and over you and constantly beating on you. So, no, I mean, it's unimaginable, you know, what that would be like, especially because killer whales are so self-aware. I mean, they're one of only a few species that can recognize themselves in a mirror. It's a very important test of self-awareness and cognition, and you know, humans obviously can recognize themselves, although young children don't start to recognize themselves in a mirror until they're about 2 years old, and elephants can recognize themselves, and dolphins can recognize themselves, and primates, and that's it really, and so the more you understand about their intelligence and their self-awareness and the degree to which they're bonded to their groups, the more you understand how horrific you know, life in a marine park might be for a killer whale.
Yeah, and it almost makes you wonder if you recognize humans, you know, when.
Well, I mean, that's the, you know, the among the former trainers, you know, that are really the backbone of this story, both for Killer in the Pool and then for the movie. We used to joke about that all the time. That really, that, you know, they're the intelligent ones, and we're the lower level animals in some ways, and we always used to compare it to Planet of the Apes, except for we're the apes mm-hmm. in this case. So there is a little bit of that. I mean, I think you do, you know, we can't really know everything. We can't know obviously what they think, but the more we learn about them in the wild, you know, the more you start to understand that they may have mental and cognitive capabilities that we don't even grasp yet. So anyways, there is that mystery about it, and it does make you turn and look at yourself a little bit and say, you know, who are we as humans to, you know, to take an animal like that just because we can and then put it to work for us, you know, 365 days a year to rake in entertainment dollars.
All right, just for entertainment and, you know, in a bathtub, a totally unnatural, depressing life. But it seems like the movie is turning a lot of people against SeaWorld. The percentage is going higher and higher, and more people seem to be protesting against SeaWorld. But I think that SeaWorld called your film distorted, didn't it? I mean, its reaction was? SeaWorld said that Blackfish was, the movie is distorted?
Yeah, they said it's distorted and unbalanced. I mean, you know, unbalanced is a little bit of a joke because it's partly, we hear mostly from the folks who think captivity is the wrong idea because SeaWorld consistently refused to talk to us and present their side of the story. And distorted, I mean, it's interesting. In the rebuttals that SeaWorld has sent around to film critics and also to CNN about the film, they've said that, you know, the film doesn't really honor all the great work that SeaWorld does in rescue and rehabbing wild marine mammals. But even when you look into something like that, you start to get a kind of queasy feeling because SeaWorld does do a lot of great, you know, work, you know, rescuing marine mammals. I was down in the Indian River Lagoon where Hub SeaWorld Institute does a lot of great work with the dolphins down there, which are struggling right now. But at the same time, you know, SeaWorld generates, you know, enormous hundreds of millions of dollars of profits every year. And, you know, they do put some money towards rescue and rehabilitation, but a lot of it's subsidized by the federal government as well. And the most important thing I always mention when people talk about, well, SeaWorld does all this great rescue and rehab, is that the rescue and rehab also serves as a backdoor for SeaWorld to get new animals. Right now at SeaWorld Florida, there's five pilot whales that were stranded over the last couple of years. And SeaWorld, you know, picked up, euthanized some, which probably they needed to do. But they always seem to tend to try to rehab the young females or the young smaller ones. And so, you know, those animals then come back to SeaWorld and they get healthy again. And then they're deemed, you know, not really fit for release again. And they become part of SeaWorld's quote-unquote collection. And the most important example of that, you know, SeaWorld also mentions frequently, you know, and Gray Stafford on Crossfire mentioned this, you know, they don't do wild captures anymore. And that's true because they learned how to breed orcas in captivity, which is a whole nother story, which once you dig into the details gets a little bit, you know, gruesome. But they do have, there was an orca called Morgan, you know, that was lost and rescued in the Netherlands, off the Netherlands in 2010. And, you know, the dolphinarium there, which SeaWorld has a long-standing relationship with going back decades, you know,
Tim, we have to take a break. We have to take a break. We'll continue our discussion with Tim Zimmerman, associate producer and co-writer of Blackfish on Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden, goveganradio.com. GoVeganRadio.com, on Twitter at GoVeganRadio. Hey, Viva La Vegan is now open in Santa Monica on Ocean Park in 28th. You know, the store in Rancho Cucamonga with over 6,000 vegan items. Now there's kind of the Viva La Vegan mini-mart in a way, but everything's vegan there. A lot of people are excited about it. The website is VivaLaVeganGrocery.com. You can also order products online. And please check out my vegan commentary on KPFA, the Pacifica Bay Area radio station, 94.1 FM, Wednesday mornings in the 8 o'clock hour, kpfa.org. Those commentaries are now archived at goveganradio.com. But forget about my commentary. Let's go on to animal rights commentary from Professor Gary Francione of Rutgers University, the first academic to teach animal rights law in an American law school, the website abolitionistapproach.com. How are you, Gary?
I'm very well, Bob. How are you this evening?
Terrific. Thanks for being with us again. It's great to have you on every week.
It's always a pleasure. It's always a pleasure. Bob, I've seen something that actually took my breath away. Bell and Evans, you're familiar with Bell and Evans. They sell chicken.
Yes, I'm aware of what you were saying. It caught my attention, too, I must say.
And so I saw the Bell and Evans website. And the Bell and Evans website, you know, they claim that they're, you know, they just, the chickens line up to be killed by Bell and Evans because it's such a pleasant experience to be wiped off the planet by Bell and Evans. And because the Bell and Evans claim that they do it so much more humanely. And so they have a page. And the page, you go to their animal welfare section, and they have what others are saying. Mm-hmm. And you go to the What Others Are Saying page, and there you see HSUS, PETA, and the Global Animal Partnership. HSUS says, the Humane Society of the United States fully supports Bell and Evans' switch to slow induction anesthesia. The SIA, that means slow induction anesthesia system, the Bell and Evans developed will improve bird welfare by eliminating live dumping and live shackling and worker contact with live birds, says Matt Prescott, spokesperson for HSUS. And then comes PETA. For the last year, we've worked closely with PETA on this project. Ingrid Newkirk, president of PETA, wrote, this is a quote from Ingrid Newkirk, Bell and Evans shows that animal welfare and good business can go hand in hand. And by listening to consumers' wishes, Bell and Evans has set a new standard for the chicken supply industry. Ingrid Newkirk of PETA tells us, quote, Bell and Evans has set a new standard for the chicken supply industry. And then global,
sad. Very sad. I'm so sad to hear that. I mean,
well, you know,
you would think she'd want to sue them for having PETA on its website, but no. This is
they're quoting her, Bob. So if it's not a quote, then if this is not an accurate quote, then Ingrid ought to do something about it. But it's on their website with the PETA logo, by the way.
I see. I'm looking at
quoting
it right now.
Ingrid saying that Bell and Evans has set a new standard for the chicken supply industry. And, you know, Ingrid just had that video that she put out a few months ago saying PETA does not support exploitation.
Happy meat. Right.
Well, you know what? False. They do. This is
wow.
If this isn't promoting happy exploitation, I don't know what is. And then we have the Global Animal Partnership. That is the organization that has developed the five-step animal welfare rating program that is used by Whole Foods Market and has on the board of directors Wayne Pacell of HSUS, as well as John Mackey. And the Global Animal Partnership is the executive director is Mayoon Park, once of Compassion Over Killing, now promoting happy exploitation. Although we at GAP, Global Animal Partnership, five-step animal welfare ratings, although we support GAP standards for the broiler chicken industry, we fill the Bell and Evans standard with SIA, that's slow induction anesthesia, takes humane animal welfare one step further. Leading livestock handling authority Temple Grandin agrees. The SIA process will be a big step forward in chicken welfare. Temple Grandin, by the way, who designs Happy Slaughterhouses and who was given a, quote, visionary award, end quote, by PETA a few years back. So this is where we are, Bob, on October 27th, 2013, in the animal movement in the United States. We've got the seller of chicken body parts, Bell and Evans, promoting the idea that they do it better and that it's happy exploitation. And we have HSUS, we have Ingrid Newkirk of PETA, and we have the Global Animal Partnership, which is basically HSUS again, telling us that this is just dandy. And the idea that this is not promoting happy exploitation is so unequivocally false, it takes my breath away that anybody could even say that. So, you know, for all of the folks who at the so-called Animal Rights 2013 National Conference at the end of June, who were saying, oh, no, we don't promote happy exploitation, that's just wrong. No, I'm sorry, it's not wrong. The animal groups do that. The large groups do that. The smaller groups do that. And let us not forget that in the love letter to John Mackey, the CEO of Whole Foods, expressing appreciation and support, the letter that was sent by Peter Singer, our father, who art in the animal rights movement. Peter Singer sent that letter in 2005, expressing appreciation and support for the happy exploitation program of Whole Foods, and it was signed by PETA, HSUS, Farm Sanctuary, Vegan Outreach, Compassion Over Killing, Mercy for Animals, all of them. So as far as I'm concerned, the animal rights movement in this country, I declare it dead. It does not exist. There is a grassroots movement. There's a grassroots movement that is trying to abolish animal exploitation and is promoting veganism as a moral baseline. It has no leadership. It has no office. It doesn't ask for donations. It's out there doing things, trying to shift the paradigm, get to the tipping point so that we can start a serious discussion about whether we have any moral justification for using animals, which I maintain that we don't. But as far as I'm concerned, this partnership between the animal groups and the institutional animal users is obscene. And to say that we have an animal movement in this country is a lie. We don't. We don't have an animal rights movement. We have an animal exploit. We have a happy exploitation movement in this country. That's what we've got. That's it. And, you know, when I wrote Rain Without Thunder in 1995, I actually was hopeful that we were going to reverse what I saw then was the animal rights movement moving in an animal welfare direction. In my wildest dreams in 1995 or 1996, whenever I wrote that book, I never thought it was going to get as bad as it is now. Mm-hmm. And so That's all I have to say. How are you doing, Bob?
I'm doing fine. I mean, I feel the same way. I'm looking for a movement that I feel doesn't exist or collapsed around me, if it ever were there. I don't know. You know, I mean, I'm looking at the Bell and Evans website too, where it says, you know, getting it right like no other facility in the world. Chickens are rendered unconscious slowly in the safety of the SIA drawers. What's the safety? They're going to be killed in them.
Right.
How is that?
The language, you know, if we could only get somebody, you know, who could get to George Orwell, wherever he is, and sort of use a Ouija board or something. This language would stun Orwell. It is so Orwellian,
right?
In terms of, I mean, the idea, the way that this is characterized. And the fact that you've got Ingrid Newkirk saying Bell and Evans has set a new standard for the chicken supply industry.
No, that does surprise me because she did say we're not for happy meat, and as you said in a video just a few months ago. So how can this be here? It's very I don't know. It's very strange that it would be here because
no, it's not strange at all, Bob. It's I mean, actually, PETA has been supporting happy exploitation for a long time now. And you know, I realize that I'm not popular when I say that sort of thing, but that's absolutely right. I mean, there's also, I've been writing about this for a while now. I've got a whole bunch of essays at abolitionistapproach.com where I talk about this. And when PETA came out with a statement before she did the video, they had a statement a few months before that. And I analyzed that statement and said it's absolutely false that PETA is not promoting happy exploitation. They most certainly are. But on a positive note, Eat Like You Care, an examination of the morality of eating animals, is doing very well. And that's a book that takes a very, very clear position on veganism. If animals matter at all morally, we cannot justify eating them, wearing them, and using them. And you can get it at Amazon.com.
Say the title again? The title of your book is?
Eat Like You Care, an examination of the morality of eating animals. You can go to Amazon, or you can go to our website, eatlikeyoucarebook.com, and that will then get you to the various places where, depending on what e-version you want or whether you want it in paper, you can get it there. But Bob, this is, you know, we talked about this last week, this whole business about people claiming that there are studies that show that animal welfare reform leads to veganism and that happy exploitation leads to veganism. That's nonsense. And you know, the message that this is sending to anybody who looks at that website, Bob, is that PETA puts its stamp of approval on eating this chicken. You can be an animal rights person. Just eat Bell and Evans chicken. They're killed in the safety
They're killed in the safety of the drawers. It says, the tunnel provides the birds with the benefit of slow induction anesthesia.
Bob, isn't this, it's bone-chilling.
It's mind-boggling. Yes, the benefit of death, the safety of murder. It's beautiful.
Right, exactly.
I love it.
There you go, Bob.
It's perfect for Halloween. It's perfect for Halloween.
I don't know.
Yeah. Were you mentioning something last week about Peter Singer saying, hey, if you're served food, you know, that's not vegan, eat it?
Yes, indeed. Yes, perhaps we can talk about that sometime. Yeah, Peter Singer takes the position that, you know, if you're in a restaurant and they bring you order something vegan, but they bring you something that's got animal products on it, it's got cheese on top. You know, if you're with non-vegans, you should just eat it, because if you don't eat it, then people are going to think you're a pain in the neck and that veganism's hard. So just, you know, go ahead and eat it, because you're actually harming animals if you don't eat the animal products, because then people are going to think that being vegan is hard, and that will dissuade them from becoming vegan.
Won't they think being vegan is inconsistent and hypocritical if one were to just, you know, compromise one's morals like that easily? Come on.
Look, as far as I'm concerned, if you eat the cheese, the message that you send to your non-vegan friends sitting there is that this is not something to take very seriously. It's a moral principle that you don't take very seriously. Yeah.
Well, he's not a vegan, though, anyway, right? Peter Singer isn't
exactly.
A vegan.
Exactly. He's flexible.
Yeah. Flexitarian, right. Okay, well, thanks for being with us again.
Thank you, Bob. I will talk with you next week, and I look forward to it.
Terrific. Thank you, Professor Francione. We will do that, and we will continue. Michael Budke next on Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden, goveganradio.com. Linden, govegan.radio.com. And once again, I'm not necessarily responsible for the content of all network commercials that run during this program. So, for vegan events around the San Francisco Bay Area, check out the website of the San Francisco Vegetarian Society. It is sfvs.org. And we have a few minutes left. I wanted to talk to Michael Budke, who has been on a whirlwind tour of California, having organized the Free the Animals Conference in Los Angeles, and then coming up to Northern California to reveal... Actually, a primate escape that happened at UC Davis that was kept a secret that we should have known about. And I wanted to invite Michael back because we never got to the subject of what's happening to dogs at the University of Oklahoma. So, hey, Michael, how are you today? You there? Michael? Am I there? Who's here? Matt, you got Michael? Matt, are you there?
Bob, can you
yes.
hear me?
Oh, there you are.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
I couldn't hear you at all, and I was looking
all
to
right.
see if I was still connected with the network.
I'm glad we've got that little technical issue handled. I was very happy you were able to give me the chance to come back and talk about the University of Oklahoma. Our investigations uncovered federal records that revealed that the University of Oklahoma was illegally killing dogs in a method of, well, they call it euthanasia, but I wouldn't, as part of a surgical experiment. They were literally electrocuting dogs through the heart with 9-volt batteries. On top of that, not only was this a unapproved method of euthanasia, the AVMA would clearly not support something like this. But this was supposed to be happening when the dogs were effectively anesthetized. But the very next citation or the very next piece of information we uncovered is that the laboratory was not using proper anesthesia. And so we're literally talking about dogs that are being electrocuted through the heart while not properly anesthetized. Not that this should ever happen, but I think what's important about this, other than just exposing the cruelty and abuse of what goes on here, this protocol, as it was set up with that non-approved method of euthanasia, was actually approved by the University of Oklahoma's Animal Care and Use Committee. That protocol went through the required legal approval process. They said that was okay. But then, on top of that, they don't even enforce the law well enough internally to make sure that these animals are receiving the required anesthesia. So what we have is a protocol that never should have been approved, not being adequately supervised so that they're not even following their own protocol. So this is really yet another instance of a laboratory that breaks the law, receives federal funding to do it, and can't even follow their own protocols, so that we're funding criminals who can't even follow their own paperwork, file it correctly, and then at the end we expect this to produce something that's going to be scientifically meaningful.
Puppy killers in lab coats.
Wrong with this picture.
Yeah. What was, was it supposedly to prove something that they could electrocute a dog in the heart? I mean, I don't know.
It's heart related research. Unfortunately, the documents we have don't actually disclose who the researchers in question are, but it was clearly what we could tell was that the experimentation was somehow heart-related, obviously, because it described the surgical procedure. But, I mean, in reality, it doesn't really make any difference with what they were supposedly trying to prove, because they weren't even following their own protocols. So it's all meaningless.
Well, I think they've proven that electrocuting a dog in the heart produces a dead dog. So, Michael Budke of Sane, S-A-E-N, online.org. We're just about out of time. Oddly enough, the Humane Slaughter Act approves of electrocution of pigs as an approved method of killing them for all crazy. But hey, and thanks for supporting us in our your $2,000 donation toward being on in Chicago and New York.
We hope to get a lot more support to get into New York and Chicago.
Thank you so much. Okay, Michael Budke.